Faith is belief without evidence. If one had evidence, one wouldn't need faith. Faith is unreliable. Faith is an unreliable process. It will not point one in the direction of the truth. The DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the main purpose of the DSM is to provide common terms and standard criteria for classifying mental disorders. The DSM grants religious exemptions to delusions. I disagree with granting religious delusion as an exemption.
I think we're going to start seeing people moving away from faith as their explanation, and they will start saying, I have evidence for it. That's where it's going, and that's a good thing. People will very often say, I believe that this is true because I have evidence. But when you start peeling back the layers, that lower layer of faith is always in play. When all those other layers start getting stripped away, that's all they have. They really don't have much more than faith. You know, I've had conversations with people of other religions on this campus and elsewhere.
For sure.
I've talked to a Muslim woman who said that she's 100% convinced that Allah is the one true God. And I think we probably agree she has the right to believe in that God. She uses faith and she hopes that Allah is real. She hopes it. And she's invested a lot of time in the belief. Right? Like, she was raised in it. She puts a lot of time in it. She goes to the mosque and does all these prayers. She's invested a lot of time in it. She hopes that it's real. She really wants it to be real because she's invested so much time in it. Mm-hmm. In what way does that make her belief any more true than yours?
My name is Daniel Ray, staff apologist with Watchman Fellowship and host of Apologetics Profile. Welcome to this episode, the special two-part episode, where senior apologist Brady Blevins and I will be discussing atheist and philosopher Peter Boghossian. Boghossian began a movement within the skeptic and atheist community in 2013 known as street epistemology. And the individual you heard at the beginning of the broadcast was Peter Boghossian himself in a 2012 lecture talking about faith as belief without evidence. In that same lecture, Boghossian went on to say that faith, he believed, should be classified as a mental disorder within the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that is used by psychiatrists and psychologists to diagnose mental disorders. These and other troubling assumptions and definitions would eventually appear in Boghossian's 2013 book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. The book outlines how atheists and skeptics can use Socratic-like conversational techniques to get Christians to doubt their faith. Since 2013, street epistemology has taken on a life of its own, with conferences, websites, and YouTube videos with a host of people uploading content and videos about these conversations where believers start to question their faith. The next few clips you heard after Boghossian are from a leading practitioner of street epistemology, Anthony Magnabosco. In the two clips, you saw Anthony define what he believed faith was, and then on a college campus, practicing street epistemology, trying to get a young Christian college student to doubt his faith. Conversations with street epistemologists can happen in a public park, on a college campus, or largely in social media. In 2019, Peter Boghossian, along with another atheist, James Lindsay, wrote this book, How to Have Impossible Conversations, a Very Practical Guide. Though the book doesn't go into great detail about street epistemology, the basic foundational ideas are still present within the book. Though not as strident in its atheism as Boghossian's first book was in 2013, How to Have Impossible Conversation still encourages the skeptic, what they call the interventionists, to use these conversational techniques in order to instill doubt in people's beliefs. On this special two-part episode of Apologetics Profile, Watchman Senior Apologist Brady Blevins and I discuss more at length Peter Boghossian's work and what street epistemology is, how to recognize it, and how to respond. If you are listening to this broadcast on the audio podcast, there is a video version available. You can find that in the links in the podcast notes below. If you're watching this on video, there is also a link to the podcast audio in the notes below. In addition to the video and the podcast, we are also featuring a 4-page profile on Peter Boghossian and street epistemology. And if you're interested in finding out more about street epistemology, I have produced 3 additional videos, the links of which you can find in the description notes below. So if you have children or grandchildren who are away at college, if you or anyone you know who is actively on social media sharing their faith, you are likely going to encounter someone practicing street epistemology. You don't want to miss these 2 episodes. So join Brady and I as we take an important look at this skeptic phenomenon known as street epistemology.
I am Brady Blevins, and welcome to Apologetics Profile. And we are going to talk about something today that maybe you have never heard of, but I guarantee if you're trying to do apologetics online, social media, Facebook, Twitter, one of those kind of platforms, I guarantee that you have probably stumbled across somebody who is practicing what we're going to be talking about. But before I get to that, and before we get to the subject today, you may realize that, especially if you're watching this, you notice that things are a little bit different. I'm sitting in the host seat today. But the voice that you will hear, or if you're watching, the face that you will see is a very recognizable face, very recognizable voice. The one, the only, the normal host of Apologetics Profile, Staff Apologist Watchman Fellowship, Daniel Ray. Thank Welcome, you. Daniel.
It's too much, Brady. It's too much. Well, thanks for having me in the other chair. Well. This is the first time I've ever been, I think, in all of our times that I've been in the guest seat. So
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Enjoy it. It's much more comfortable than the host seat, where I got to actually pay attention to the time and make sure that we're on time, all that fun stuff. So,
yeah.
But anyway, okay, Daniel, what we're going to talk about today is something that, to say you have extensive knowledge in this subject is an understatement, because not only have you studied it, not only have you interacted on multiple levels, not just a Twitter thing here or there, not just at the level I've interacted with. I mean, you've gone above and beyond, is this thing that we call street epistemology. And now we're going to get into that a little bit later. But this is something that is very, very important for believers to know about. But before we get into street epistemology, what it is, why we even need to be talking about it, we've got to start with the guy who really started this whole thing. And his name is Peter Boghossian. Mm-hmm. And so, Dan, I would like for you to just start off by telling us a little bit about Peter and just kind of how this whole thing came to be.
Right. Dr. Boghossian, Peter Boghossian, is a full-time philosophy professor at Portland State University in Oregon. He is an outspoken atheist and has several publications professionally, but has in 2013 wrote a book called A Manual for Creating Atheists. And Peter, being an outspoken atheist, wrote this book and suggested to the atheist community that instead of arguing with believers over apologetics, you know, the reliability of the Bible and the arguments, traditional arguments and evidences for Christianity, that you take a different approach. And instead of arguing about the basics for Christianity, you argue about how people came to know their belief in God. How did they come to believe in God? And so using his repertoire of philosophical knowledge, he created this idea called street epistemology. And basically what it is this idea that if you can learn a few conversational techniques, you can take those conversational techniques to the streets and engage people in conversations that avoid the typical Christian atheist argument, but instead get down into the epistemic questions of how you know, how did you come to know that your belief in God is true? But Peter was also involved a few years ago in an academic test, if you will. He and two other colleagues wrote a host of academic papers and tried to get them published in various peer-reviewed academic journals. But the papers were all hoaxes. They were ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Some were very risque in their titles. Some of them actually got published, and it became a huge scandal. And Mr. Boghossian mm-hmm. was disciplined, I understand, by Portland State University for that stunt. He did not tell anybody what he was doing. And but that's all online. It's out there. He's in 2012 at Portland State. He gave a talk that equated basically Jesus to the Easter Bunny. And he's not favorable to people of faith. He defines mm-hmm. faith as believing something that you don't know and belief without evidence. And he was in a discussion on Unbelievable with Justin Brierley yes. back in 2012, 2013 with philosopher Tim McGrew, who held him accountable for those colloquial definitions. And Tim very eruditely and very simply mm-hmm. showed Peter that his definitions of faith were wrong and not in accordance with anything that any Orthodox theologian of the last 2000 years would agree to. Boghossian seems to have come up with them autodidactically, or Peter would claim that he's just using definitions the way Christians use them. And there is some kind of truth to that, sadly, that we have this idea
yeah,
about really faith that there is no evidence and we're just believing blindly. And so there is some kind of truth to that. But Peter in the book, A Manual for Creating Atheists, he believes that faith is a mental disorder. And that the diagnostic and statistical manual that yeah. psychologists and psychiatrists use give religious faith an exemption from a mental disorder. But he classifies it as a mental disorder and wants the DSM authors to remove religion from that exemption. So he's very aggressive in this, and the book was a sort of conversational methodological approach to undermining people's faith. That's how it all got started, and that's basically who Peter Boghossian is.
It seems like he trades on this really, and I don't mean this in a mean or pejorative way, but he seems like he's trading on the ignorance of Christians in their faith walk. I mean, even like this use, because I think the word faith is the perfect example, because how many times have we heard or maybe even said ourselves, oh, well, that's just a leap of faith. We're just going to take a leap of faith, or, you know, hey, it's just blind faith. And all we're really doing is cementing this idea that faith is, as he would put it, belief without evidence, pretending mm-hmm. to know something that you don't know, when mm-hmm. in reality, that's not what the word means at all. I know that this came up in conversation a while back with a mutual atheist friend of ours. And I end up making I made a 4-minute version of the video that went on, made a 16-minute version. Well, I took a 16-minute version and made it 4. And then I ended up going on a atheist YouTube show about it. And we actually came to a place of agreement. Once I posited the evidence, they were willing to accept the evidence, which is probably shows more of their intellectual honesty than anything else. And you don't always get that kind of intellectual honesty when you talk to anybody, regardless of whether they're a Christian or an atheist or mm-hmm. any other faith system. But to some extent, you know, you look at Peter's work and say, well, yeah, Peter, this is you kind of got a point here in that we should know what we believe. Mm-hmm. But I think it's safe to say that when we start digging into street epistemology, and we start trying to really understand what's going on, this goes beyond just simply knowing what you believe, that there's actually some tactics, mm-hmm. if you will, that are used within street epistemology. I mean, you mentioned, you didn't say, I don't think you said this word exactly, but I mean, they're using a Socratic method to put the, in this case, the believer in the hot seat to try to draw out their lack of knowledge in certain subjects, which, I mean, my goodness, you want to draw out my lack of knowledge in certain subjects, it's not very hard to do, as is the case with most of us who are going to answer questions honestly. Right. So can you talk a little bit about the tactic that's behind street epistemology?
Yes, it's very important to say at the outset, I didn't mention it in the first question, but Peter wrote a 2019 book, co-wrote it with a fellow colleague, James Lindsay. Lindsay wrote a book a couple of years ago, Everybody is Wrong About God. Lindsay is also an atheist. So they wrote this 2019 book. It's a little toned down in its atheistic intent. It's called How to Have Impossible Conversations. And it is written in such a way that it's very readable. And I found myself agreeing with a lot of the tactics in terms of what does it take to have a good conversation with someone? These are things that we can all agree with. In fact, probably the Christian counterpart to this How to Have Impossible Conversations is Greg Kuchel's book, Tactics. I'm sure I have actually have not read Greg's book yet. I need to, but I'm sure there's a lot of overlap in terms of how to approach people about conversations that you're having about God. What are some good ways, good questions? And so I would affirm that there are good things in street epistemology. I think the primary thing that I find to be the case, without judging the sincerity or intents of street epistemologists, is the focus on having a civil dialogue over contentious issues, things that we can agree upon. So there's good conversational methodological approaches to how do you have a nice conversation with somebody about intense things that you agree about, you disagree about. Of course, we do that with the book club. So we can agree that there's some good stuff in what Boghossian and Lindsay say about impossible conversations. That being said, though, there are two terms that you need to be aware of in both books. One in the first book is the epistemologist. And in the second book is what they call the interventionist. Mm-hmm. They don't really focus on epistemology in the second book. They don't. It comes up, but the term interventionist is used. But the idea is, Brady, that the street epistemologist or the interventionist has the superior epistemology. So we're going to go out with our superior epistemology, and we are going to give people the gift of doubt. So it's like, you know, the National Forest Service and the government, sometimes they do controlled burns in areas where there's over deforestation. They try to reduce, you know, keep it prevents forest fires from getting out of control, these controlled burns. And so what an atheist is kind of doing with these conversational techniques is they kind of perceive themselves as going in and doing a controlled burn. We're going to get rid of the tangled garbage about how you came to believe what you believed. So in the one sense, I think the approach is good. Let's get people thinking about how they came to this belief. Did mom and dad just give it to me? Did I just learn this from a book and just went, okay. So there's another good thing there. However, the street epistemologist interventionist is not going to tell you what the right epistemology is. They're just going to assume that my goal is to cause doubt in yours. And so that's one of the things where they come in, and you know, Christians do this. We come in, anybody that believes strongly in what they believe thinks we have the truth and we need to share it with you in such a way to bring you to the truth. But the street epistemologist will not ever really concede to what the proper epistemology is. And to me, if you're going to cause doubt in someone else's cognitive processes, you need to at least be willing to share the standard by which you're judging other people's ways of coming to the truth. How do you know that you're causing doubt
exactly
is the right thing to do? And so they don't, neither book outlines this. Boghossian kind of pays lip service to logic and reason and science, but you're never given a foundation of what the proper epistemology is. And if you are a formal philosopher like Tim McGrew, and you know the ins and outs of formal epistemological theories and philosophies, it's a complex, deep, and philosophical topic. But that's not how the street epistemologists are using it. They're using conversational tactics to try to get you to doubt.
Why would 12 people who followed Jesus around, heard what he said, and then saw him die, lie about him coming back to life, only to know that they were going to be persecuted and put to death for saying that. Like,
does that get you to the 98%?
That's kind of like the main thing. It's like the biology aspect, and then that as well.
I'm just going to test that is actually your main thing. I'm going to ask you a question. If it turned out, this is kind of weird. And I'm
no, go ahead.
Again, I'm just stimulating conversation.
Yeah.
If it turned out that there was substantial evidence to a criteria of your satisfaction that they were in fact lying, would that reduce your confidence from 98% down
probably,
to like
80,
70, maybe lower than that?
Probably.
Okay.
And so that's the basic gist of their overall methodology. Now, it's primarily to get Christians and theists to doubt. That's what it's been all about. Street epistemology has been limited to the atheist community. And I have not run into somebody who practices street epistemology who is not an atheist. So this is a skeptical movement within the skeptic community. It's preached at, I say preached, it is, at conferences, online seminars. There's streetepistemology.com. There's a script that you can follow. And they're all tactics for how to get people to doubt their particular beliefs without ever revealing what their particular epistemological foundations are themselves.
Because ultimately they see doubt as a virtue. Mm-hmm. And it just seems so just mind blowing to me as a Christian, because I mean, let's just be honest for a moment. When we're witnessing to someone of a different faith, whether they're Mormon or Muslim or Jehovah's Witness or whatever the case may be, or an atheist for that matter, we absolutely want them to doubt their worldview or their position, their theological position, but we don't want to lead them at doubt. We want to offer them something. We want to show them the folly of their position, but yet at the same time say, but there's a solution. And that solution is Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And you can have, you can have eternal life in the presence of God Almighty if you'll receive this gift of eternal life. And mm-hmm. You almost look at the street epistemologist and say, like, kind of what's the point, man? I mean, like, why do you even bother to do this? And outside of seeing doubt as a virtue, I really don't see any other point or reason for them doing this. Is there another point or reason for them doing this?
Well, that's the thing, Brady. It does not seem to go beyond keeping the conversation civil, which I will applaud. And every street epistemologist that I've engaged on the surface has been cordial and civil. Where it starts to break down is when you start questioning what you just said. Why are you doing this? Why are you so interested in my level of confidence? That's another thing they want to know. They want to know the confidence level that you have in your belief in God. And they're very insistent upon that. And we will talk about that later. But the doubt, giving the gift of doubt, that's it. But as you know, many philosophers have said, and what is epistemically obvious, is that in order to doubt something, you need a standard of truth, and no street epistemologist is ever forthwith. They never explain what their standard of truth is. Yeah. They are just going for the doubt. Now, in the 8 years that since Peter Boghossian has written that first book, the street epistemology movement, he's kind of stepped away from it himself, but it's taken on a life of its own. It's still predominantly a skeptic phenomenon. They do talk about other things than religion. They talk about New Age things. They talk about alternative medicines and oils and politics and gun control and, you know, whatever. There's a wide variety of popular SE, what we call SE, street epistemology, videos out there of other topics other than religion.
Yeah.
But if you watch these conversations, the interlocutor, the SE practitioner, will open it up with, I have 5 minute comment. Hey, would you like to have a chat for 5 minutes about anything from, you know, Cheetos to cats to whatever you find to be true about the world, or what are your most deeply held beliefs? So they go from the trivial. And then that last question always is something like, or something that you hold dear and believe deeply and sincerely. And so that's kind of a hook to see if they can snap.
They're baiting you to say the Bible.
They want to go that route. So they endure all the other conversations to get that one. And that's still predominantly the most popular videos on YouTube of street epistemology are the ones that get Christians to go, where they reduce their confidence level. So one thing that they do, they'll say, how confident are you in your belief in God? And they kind of elicit a number. You say, well, I'm 100% confident. And then they'll define 100.
Oh, really?
They'll define 100. And then their definition of 100 causes you to dial down your confidence. That's not what I mean by 100. So I'll tick it down to 98.
How confident are you that Jesus and God exist?
All right. I'd say 100%.
100%? Yeah, I'm going to define 100% and just let me know, because it's a number. And and you can change the number. I don't care. But 100% to me is like
no doubt.
No doubt. Uh-huh. There's no way I can be wrong. I'm not asking questions anymore. Uh-huh. I am certain, closed-minded on the position. I'm closed on the position. 100%.
Let's go 98%.
98%?
Yeah, everybody has those periods of doubt, right?
I think so. Uh-huh. And I think it's actually healthier to not be absolute about what you believe.
And Brady, the thing is, I would say they're predominant, whether it's politics or abortion or gun control or New Age spiritualism or alternative medicines or essential oils or Christianity, all that street epistemologists want to do is cause doubt. Now, we might find some common ground with them, as you mentioned earlier, cultic mindsets, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, alternative religions, Islam, that we would probably have some similarities in the kinds of conversations that we have with people that we don't think are adhering to the truth correctly. There are stories of people coming out of Mormonism because of street epistemology. So we would have some, as I've said before, we would have some overlap in the tactics, in the approaches of questioning and having that conversation. But the difference between the Christian apologist and the street epistemologist is that the street epistemologist just leaves the fire going and lets it burn and doesn't help contain it once it's started. If you reduce a theist's confidence, I mean, they don't give Mormons a community to join. They don't give them an alternative. They just light the fire, you know, and then they walk away.
We're going to take away your family and your job and everything. Yeah.
And we're not going to give you anything in return except science, logic, and reason, which, you know, we can embrace science, logic, and reason in our worldview as well. But they leave. They think giving the gift of doubt is the highest thing they can do. That I think to me would be the primary motive for any street epistemologist, causing doubt in other people's worldview without revealing their own.
It's real easy to find a flaw in an individual or an individual's understanding in this particular case, but it's much harder to be able to provide something better. And so it's almost like, we'll take your lack of knowledge of what you claim to believe. We're going to run with it. And then we're just going to leave you dangling and you can just kind of be left off in the dust. And what is sad is that hopefully this isn't the case so much, you know, like in Christianity, but when you do go to places like those who are in Mormonism, I mean, you could be costing this person their family, their job, their everything they've ever known, and you're not giving them anything to replace it. You're just leaving them out there on a ditch, unemployed, divorced, and estranged from their children and their parents and everybody else, and that's a bad place to be. But the one thing I would say I do appreciate is, I am a big fan of the Socratic method, and I've read Greg Kokel's book Tactics. I read the first version. I read the 10-year anniversary. I teach it as part of my classes here at Arlington Baptist University, where I'm a professor at, and I'm a big fan of it. And there is overlap there in terms of, I mean, questions like, how did you come to that conclusion? What do you mean by that? And understand that I think it's important for us as Christians to understand that we ought to have answers for those questions. And we ought to be able to know what we mean when we say God. We ought to know what the real definition of faith is, and shame on us when we don't. I think if anything, the one thing I do, as weird as it sounds, appreciate from this is the fact that we do need to study to show ourselves approved unto God. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a really, really good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Man, believe it or not, the clock is ticking on us now. We're definitely gonna have to have a part two to this. Of course, we knew this going into it,
right?
And we'll start to unpack what a conversation would look like, and we'll do that in part number two. But I want to develop this a little bit more because you mentioned Peter's second book, and I've heard some street epistemologists refer to the first book, Manual for Creating Atheists, as the Old Testament, and then the second book, How to Have Impossible Conversations, as the New Testament, which, I mean, hey, as a Christian, I kind of appreciate the fact that they're thinking in that direction.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit more? What do they mean by that?
Sure. Boghossian is aggressive. And his aggressive form of atheism is very apparent in that book, almost God delusion-like. In fact, Michael Shermer, in the introduction to A Manual for Creating Atheists, skeptic Michael Shermer offers an introduction to which he says the God delusion and A Manual for Creating Atheists should be software used to deprogram theists. So it is that kind of aggressive, Dawkins-esque catalyst, and a lot of skeptics even will say, yeah, it's a little aggressive for me, I'm not quite there, but it started something. So you can't take A Manual for Creating Atheists and say all street epistemologists like read that and go line by line and quote it. But I think so maybe they've laid aside that aggressiveness, but it was a catalyst that began the movement. But there are things that remain true to SE practitioners that come out of A Manual for Creating Atheists. One is that the definition of faith, that's still very predominant in the minds of street epistemologists. They think faith is just unreliable, period, no matter how you define it. They find that to be, you know, that's what they're after, is attacking that definition of faith. The new book with Lindsay, James Lindsay, is toned down. I would say, though, that the level of skeptic, lack of a better word, aggression is right under the surface, but the language is toned down. So it is kinder and gentler, but the intent and some of the definitions and some of the approaches, they don't deal with religion directly. So that takes the edge off of it. But they use a lot of examples in when they describe tactics. And the examples are, they don't paint religion. There are a lot of religious examples in the book that are not favorable to Christianity. In fact, I outline in the video that I did on that book that it's basically a subtle counter-apologetic. So all their examples, well, here's a conversational example about what we're talking about. And really the conversational example is a kind of counter-apologetic argument. And I've heard all of them. I've heard a lot of counter-apologetic arguments in my day. And these are the top ones. They talk about evolution, the God being immoral for all the things he did in the Old Testament, allegedly. They talk about slavery. So the big atheist objections are embedded in the examples that they give when they talk about street or interventionist techniques. So it is softer and gentler in terms of, you know, the aggressiveness that was, you know, so explicit in the first book. But I think that atheists go out there and make atheists is still there in that book, but the language is toned down somewhat. What's interesting, Brady, you bring up Old and New Testament, which brings me to something that we can wrap up with here. Some street epistemologists, people that practice, it's wide open. I mean, people have YouTube channels, people have pages, people are going out and having these discussions online with videos and all this stuff. It varies from individual to individual. So there is a script. I mean, there's streetepistemology.com with a script and how to do it and what's all about. And here's some videos and content creators. But on the other hand, you get down into the field of practitioners and it varies. Some people say you shouldn't use street epistemology exclusively for atheist evangelism. Some people say it's good for getting people out of Mormonism. Some people say, hey, why are you knocking SE? It's a good conversational tactic to make civility the thing again. So it's all over the map in terms of what it is and what it's not. Mm-hmm. But one thing that's running through the community right now is the question of ethics. What we were just talking about at the beginning of the broadcast, is it ethical to cause doubt in someone's belief system? if you're not going to stick around and offer something in return or help them out of it in some way, if you're just causing doubt, that seems somewhat unethical. And there are people in the SE community that are asking these questions.
Hey, this is what I'm doing. Is that okay with you? But they don't, most of the time people have never heard of street epistemology, let alone epistemology, before the talk. And the way they put it was, I'm about to do a brainwashing technique or a manipulative conversation technique. Do you consent to being manipulated in this conversation? That's the way they analogize that type of consent.
Hey.
Hey, I just had a question. What are you doing?
I'm interviewing people.
Oh.
My first name is Anthony.
Miguel?
Yes, sir. Nice to meet you. Yeah, I'm just interviewing strangers about how they arrived at their God belief. And just,
oh, cool.
Do you want to do a quick interview?
Yeah, for sure. All
right, awesome. I'll time it for 5.
Okay.
Miguel.
Well.
What God do you believe in, dude?
I believe in Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior.
Why?
Because I know he died on the cross and I know he's the Almighty God.
Okay. How confident are you that the belief is true? If 100% was, I'm 100% confident that Jesus died on the cross for me, and 0% is I'm not confident at all that Jesus died for me, where would you be on the scale?
On the 100%.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I've had conversations with people of other religions on this campus and elsewhere.
For sure.
I've talked to a Muslim woman who said that she's 100% convinced that Allah is the one true God, and I think we probably agree she has the right to believe in that God. She uses faith and she hopes that Allah is real. She hopes it, and she's invested a lot of time in the belief, right? Like, she was raised in it, she puts a lot of time in it, she goes to the mosque and does all these prayers. She's invested a lot of time in it, she hopes that it's real. She really wants it to be real because she's invested so much time in it.
Mm-hmm.
In what way does that make her belief any more true than yours? If you have no way of knowing if you are more correct in the belief than that Muslim woman, how could you possibly be at the 100% mark on the confidence of your belief?
And it can be spun to where you can console yourself that it's not unethical. I'm really trying to help these people. Mm-hmm. But if you just go in and are you just going to go in and help the Forestry Service, you know, light controlled burns and not do anything about it? You're going to tell them about it? You know, are you the professional burn lighter? Are you the professional street epistemologist who knows that they have the right epistemology and the right epistemic tools to cause doubt in anybody you talk to? Really? That's significant. And I asked one significant street epistemologist who's in the movement, have been doing it for years. I asked him, I said, what is the right epistemology to have? His answer was very telling. And this is on video. He said, I don't have to have one. I'm not an ivory tower philosopher. I don't have to have the right epistemology. This is just a conversational technique.
What do you believe is the proper epistemology? What's the right philosophy of knowledge to have about epistemology? What's the right one? I'm assuming that...
And as street epistemologists, we are not in academia. We are not in the ivory tower. This is merely a conversational method. So we don't have to be academics with like a solid answer to this question. I have my own preference, but it's not like we as street epistemologists need this necessarily. It's not like we are epistemologists.
You know,
academic versions of it.
It's not uncommon to initiate a talk with a complete stranger, identify a belief that they hold, that they really think is true, and after 5 minutes, they are usually a little less confident in something that they were absolutely sure was true. And it's very rare to see that these days, and that's why I think that this topic is perfect for the skeptics here at this conference. How can I express street epistemology as an equation? So I was thinking, well, it originated from the Socratic method, and then we add all this other stuff to it, and that's where we get street epistemology. In fact, the author of the book teaches philosophy, so he had that as a background, and I think that was a major motivation. But when we look at the other elements that convert the Socratic method into street epistemology, or SE, it's science. we want to go. We want these conversations to go where the science suggests that it should go, and we want to test it. So some examples here are modern psychology, motivational interviewing. SE heavily draws from motivational interviewing. I never knew it until I started uploading videos, and people who are in that field said, I went to school for 8 years and studied what you're doing. And it's just really interesting to see how it heavily borrows from these. Cognitive behavioral therapy, hostage negotiation, cult exiting, critical thinking, interpersonal skills.
The ethics are coming to the surface. You can't just go out and cause doubt unless you think you possess the right method or you know what's true. So there's an ethical system, you know, speaking of the Old and New Testament idea of street epistemology, there is an ethical question bubbling to the surface about all this.
So it's basically, I don't have to have the right answer, but I can certainly tell you that you don't have the right answer. Mm-hmm. And I'm not responsible at any point in time.
Right.
That to me seems maybe to be one of the biggest differences between because I know Kokel, he refers to Boghossian's work as tactics for atheists. Mm-hmm. And that's his wording, not mine. And I think we're at a fundamental split in the road between the two, in that as we use tactics as a Christian, I'm talking about the book, that is pointing to taking them to a place where you can give them Christ, where we can give them something, where we offer them a worldview, an epistemology, even if you will, that works. It works in reality. And so I think that may be one of the most significant points, in that we're not looking to just dump these folks off and let that be the case. Well, we got about a minute or two left here before we run out of time for today. Is there kind of anything in conclusion to this part of our conversation that you'd like to throw in right now, Daniel?
Yes. One thing is, don't assume the intent. What I mean by intent, we've just kind of been talking about the intention of it. What I mean in terms of someone's sincerity.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying, that at the level that they approach you, most will be civil and kind. Don't judge that. I mean, maybe there are some who believe sincerely that atheism is the best thing out there, and they really want to help you into the atheist community. Some are obviously using this as a sneaky tactic to destroy your faith. But if they're kind at the outset, don't assume the worst. Take advantage of the civility, and in turn, 1 Peter 3:15, with gentleness and reverence, return the civility. It doesn't mean you're not going to have difficulty once the conversation progresses. There's always that stand firm, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. So you're going to find yourself thinking, you know, what's going on in that person's brain, but just assume the civility and continue with the conversation. And I would say, as we'll talk about in the next episode, I will say, ask them questions too, and we'll get into, you know, how we can do that as well. But maintain that civility, keep your cool. And, you know, even though, you know, they are atheists, we're not sitting here telling you don't talk to them. We're just simply giving you the basic foundation of where they're coming from, because it's good to engage people about your faith. So we're not saying avoid talking to them. We're just giving you the background about where street epistemology is coming from.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say we're saying, no, please do talk to them, but be aware of what you might run across.
Right.
And even with that, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, because we don't need to prejudge this person's motive. Now, I mean, they may be a snake in the grass, and that may be the case, but let's let them earn that before we impose that on them. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a really great piece of wisdom to finish the section off on. So, all right, Dan, this has been so much fun. We're going to have to pick this up in part two, where we're going to actually talk about what a conversation with a street epistemologist looks like. And most importantly, how do we respond when we get into this? And Dan, I know you've been in literally hundreds of these conversations. I just wrapped up a conversation with a street epistemologist, and so we'll get into that. We'll talk a little bit more about all that good stuff. So Dan, it was great talking to you on this one, and I look forward to digging into the second part, because I really think that the listeners are going to enjoy it, and I've already learned so much from you off just walking through this experience. I can't wait for you to be able to share even more of what you know. So Dan, thank you so much.
Oh, you bet. It was fun. We'll have some more fun in part two.
Absolutely. Well, on behalf of Daniel Ray and myself, I'm Brady Blevins and Watchman Fellowship. You've been listening to Apologetics Profile, and we'll look forward to picking up this conversation on part two of Apologetics Profile next week. See you then.
This episode of Apologetics Profile has been a production of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas. For more information on this and any of our other podcast episodes or resources, visit watchman.org today.